Children who are being taught mathematics often balk at the idea of negative numbers, thinking them to be fictional entities, and only learn later that they are useful for expressing opposite directions of things, such as considering a debt and an amount of money with a negative sum. Similarly, students in mathematics often are puzzled by the idea of complex numbers, saying that it makes no sense to be able to take the square root of something negative, and only realizing later that these can have the meaning of two-dimensional direction and magnitude, or that they are essential to our modern understanding of electrical engineering. Our discussion today will be much more abstract than that. Much like in our discussion in Episode 5, Language of the Universe, we will be talking how math and physics draw inspiration from one another. We're going to talk about what different fields, such as the real, complex, and quaternion fields, seem to predict about our universe. So how are real numbers related to classical mechanics? What does this mean complex numbers and quaternions are related to? And what possible physics exist? All of this and more on this episode of Breaking Math. Episode 41, Reality is More Than Complex. I'm Sophia.
And I'm Gabriel.
And this is Breaking Math. With us again, we had on Alex Alanis, who was on the episode Syntax Matters. And Alex, thank you for being on the show.
You're welcome.
And Alex is one of my coworkers. By the way, hi, everyone. It's great to be back. I know I've been gone for quite a long time. I've been very, very busy at home, so it feels great to be back. I've been working behind the scenes, but now I'm back in front of a mic, and boy, it feels good. So, yeah, and as you also know, Alex is one of my coworkers, properly Dr. Alex, or Dr. Alanis, if you will. Alex, will you tell us a little bit about your pedigree in STEM specifically?
Well, I have a bachelor's degree in physics, a master's degree in mathematics. That's all classes, no thesis. I was heading towards a doctoral degree in math. Decided to go back to physics to stick to the real world. So I'm a particle physicist by training.
Awesome, awesome. And you've worked at a few national labs, is that right?
I did 8 years at Los Alamos National Laboratory, working as a nuclear weapons, what they call a designer.
Okay. Very good. And then for the sake of this episode, which is on mathematics and physics, will you tell us a little bit about how your background influenced your contributions to this episode?
Roughly for 10, maybe 15 years after I finished my doctoral degree, I wanted to dot every I and cross every T and just codify physics in as simple a way as possible, which is what is inspiring this episode.
Awesome. And also part of what inspires this episode are a lot of, I guess you'll call them, water cooler conversations that Alex and I have at work, where we just chat in between cubicles, you know, during our downtime. And, you know, there's been a very, very strong desire to make something for people studying physicists that help them to see the big picture. Would you say that's probably a pretty good representation?
It is. And to back it up, I've written probably 1,000 pages. Most of them are available online through a Google Drive that are step-by-step that go and derive quantum mechanics every inch of the way, every I dotted, every T crossed.
So if our listeners want to actually read the derivations of some of the stuff that we talk about, please send us an email.
And you can get a hold of us at breakingmathpodcast@gmail.com. In fact, if you want to talk to us, you can go to patreon.com/breakingmath. We have the tensor poster available there for $23.46 per poster, plus $15 shipping in the United States. We're doing free shipping for a while, but it just doesn't make sense. It was taking a little bit more time for us to actually mail out the posters than it was to have the posters help us bring you this show. Then that's the tensor poster, which talks about the tensors, which are used all over math. They're used in quantum mechanics. They can be used in
Maxwell's equations.
In Maxwell's equations, and you could use them in general relativity, which the last part of the poster talks about.
Yeah, and general relativity does not always mesh very well with quantum mechanics, which this episode will be very heavy into quantum mechanics. So
We're not going to totally get into exactly why, because it's going to be a long episode. But we're also on Twitter at Breaking Math Pod. Facebook.com/BreakingMathPodcast, where we have a poster available for, it's not $15 shipping, it's $12.50 shipping, but we have that poster available there, and you could go check out some applets at BreakingMathPodcast.com, and that's all of our plugs. So one of the cool things that I like about this episode is that it touches on this theme that we've visited a few times, I think, in Breaking Math, of physics and mathematics informing each other in like this almost spooky way. So What episode, on our physics episode, what did we use as an example?
Oh my goodness. Wow, it's been, you know what, that puts me on the spot a little bit. It's been almost 2 years now since we've done the physics episode, the original physics episode, Language of the Universe. I know that I talked a lot about Richard Feynman, who is very vocal about the relationship between mathematicians and physicists. What were some of the examples we used? My goodness.
Guys, it's been so long ago. If you want to hear those examples, go to Language of the Universe, episode 5, available where you're listening now.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But of course, mathematics is the language of the universe, and the wonderful thing is that you can have discoveries in mathematics that don't show up in physics until later on. And I think a couple of those examples are things like imaginary numbers that were part of mathematics before they were part of physics.
Oh yeah, and basically, what this episode is also going to be about, right, is what physics is our possible in right, something like that.
Correct. Mathematicians and physicists together have figured out that they just can't go willy-nilly creating theories. There are rules and restrictions, and they're very simple, actually.
Yep. And there's
physics are known for being willy-nilly.
There's going to be a lot of physics that's discussed in this episode, but it all accumulates in talking about something called the Dirac equations and something called Lorentz invariance. So those are the punchlines. We're going to talk about that at the very end. Leading up to that, we talk about conservation. We talk about the Schrodinger equation. We're going to talk about Maxwell's equations. What else? What else is on the plate?
Klein-Gordon equation.
Klein-Gordon equations.
And how it's all wrapped up with algebraic topology in fiber bundle theory.
Yep.
Alex, can you tell us what kind of universes can you have physics in, the way that we understand what physics, like what can we apply our current formulations of physics to, what dimensions and stuff?
So currently we understand the universe as a four-dimensional space-time manifold. Where quantum mechanics...
And real quick, can you explain for our audience what a manifold is?
A manifold is just a geometrical structure, the surface of a plane, a three-dimensional space, anywhere where you can have vector fields and tensor fields and things are differentiable, etc.
Yeah, and so basically a vector field, you could say that this is just a an area kind of virtual space, and some kind of dimensional space.
A map for
yeah, real. A map. There
a
we
fold
go.
Out map could be a manifold.
Yeah, that's what manifold means literally too. So
cool.
I was trying to literally think of. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and of course for our listeners, we're going to do our best. And Alex, we appreciate your patience as we interrupt you so many times and say, "Wait, stop! Can you give a concrete example of that?" All in the name of making this information very accessible. So we appreciate your patience with that ahead of time.
Certainly.
So anyway, can you have this manifold?
So essentially, the what's inspiring this episode is the progression from quantum mechanics, which was experimentally foisted on us, so we couldn't deny it, and then the addition of the weak nuclear force and how we figured methods to unify it as electroweak theory, and the strong nuclear force, and now we have the unification of these three forces called the standard model. There's a progression of mathematical ideas that... seemingly you could test out more, you know, alternate universes, richer universes, such as you talked about grand unified theories. In parallel to that, during the 1930s and 1940s, mathematicians were putting together these structures called fiber bundle theory in algebraic topology. And it turns out that they are the same structures that general relativity uses and that the standard model uses. And the value of the mathematical approach is that they have studied which manifolds are not nice, don't have nice properties like differentiability. So they inform us as to what types of physics, you know, what types of hypothetical universes may exist out there,
yeah,
as opposed to just being carte blanche, keep going.
So an example of that, and I always look for any excuse to mention Rick and Morty. In the universe of Rick and Morty, any universe at all exists. They have like the blender dimension and like, you know, all kinds of dimensions. So that's not actually possible. There used to be an idea that all possible universes exist. Like there's a universe that exists where we are 50 feet tall or whatever.
One thing right away about those kind of universes that you constrain, and Alex, correct me if I'm speaking out of turn, is that just like there is an infinite amount of values between 0 and 1, but there's also, like, for example, an infinite amount of values between 0 and 1 that are... There's an infinite amount of values between 0 and 1/3 and between 2/3 and... one. So even though you have an infinite amount of possible universes, you can constrain those just within the universe itself by what is actually, what can actually happen. Because there's not going to be a universe where things just kind of break the laws, I think, of statistics and stuff. I mean, maybe to clarify this, how do you define a physics? What is recognizable as a physics? Like, what are we working with in this episode?
So just to clarify, there is the many worlds theory of quantum mechanics, that every possible universe exists. That's loose language. It means variations of, you know, we're famous movie stars in some other universe, and that doesn't violate quantum mechanics. What I mean by other types of universes would be, for instance, physicists often study gravity in two-dimensional manifolds. It makes gravity theories much more amenable. Superstring theories are, you know, have 11 dimensions because of mathematical reasons to make the math work. And that's what I mean. Go ahead.
So would you say that these are just, we take the core expressions of, which we'll be talking about, I think, on this show today, like for classical mechanics, I mean, for like quantum mechanics, we have the Schrodinger equation, which we'll be talking about. You take these basic equations and you just extend them to more dimensions or less, fewer dimensions, correct?
Well, what the path that people discovered in the 20s was you can take, you can sum the potential energy and the kinetic energy and algebraically, and you can turn that into a differential equation over the complex numbers. So when you look at a conserved system, say a spring mass that's just sitting there oscillating forever, if you turn that into the Schrodinger equation with the right transformations, you will now have a quantized spring, much like a carbon-carbon atom, and it will have a finite spectra.
Which we'll get into in the next section. Awesome. So without further ado, here is Reality is More Than Complex. We're going to start off by talking about the conservation of energy and how it could lead to the Schrodinger equations, and then how we can talk about higher dimensional, and then we could talk about more involved fields like the quaternions and how the Schrodinger equation turns into the Klein-Gordon equation.
Mm-hmm. We're also going to get into Maxwell's equations that describe electromagnetism. We're going to talk about how they can be written in more than one form and what that applies to. We're also going to talk about the Dirac equation, and that relates to everything that we've spoken to up until that point. Following that, later in the episode, we'll talk about tools like Lorentz transforms and what that means both mathematically as well as in the world of physics.
And then finally, we're going to end up with talking about a little short discussion of symmetry and fiber bundles and how it ties the whole discussion together.
This will be a fun episode, very much related to Language of the Universe, like part two, just with more robust proofs.
Very much. Now, you're telling us off air, Alex, that there's a wave formulation of classical mechanics, but before we get into that, we have to talk about exactly what classical mechanics is. I mean, classical mechanics is a ballpark example. I mean, it's just with physics without relativity, just in three-dimensional space plus time, right?
Indeed, classical mechanics, I think of it as Newton's laws.
Yeah, and Newton's laws let's talk about real quick what a closed system is. Now, a closed system in classical mechanics and really all physics is a system where you have, it's a system of energy, right? You have energy that is your potential energy in your system plus the kinetic energy in the system, right?
If it's closed, it's a constant, yes.
So one example that I have always liked personally is basically like if you go down a slide, at the very top of the slide you have a lot of potential energy but very little kinetic energy, and once you get to the bottom of the slide you have a lot of kinetic energy but your potential energy for the system at which potential is zero when you get to the bottom of the slide, you have kinetic energy that increases in as much as that decreases, correct?
Yes.
There's tons and tons of examples like this. I mean, you know, like there's roller coaster examples. I mean, all of the middle school experiments, basically, you know, from dropping things, you know, just a simple demonstration of gravity or a spring in a box or things like that. So these are all the classical examples.
And the reason why I like these examples, too, is because it's with these springs or roller coasters, you have friction and you have like the heat released in the spring, which radiates into the universe. So that's why if you do it in a lab, it's not going to be a closed system, right? You can't physically perfectly model a frictionless pulley.
Frictionless is, unless you're talking about superconducting materials, no, you're not going to get that in a lab.
Yeah. So the interesting thing too about potential energy is that it takes the form, it is kinetic energy, correct me if I'm wrong, is always related to the velocity, at least in classical mechanics, the velocity, well, actually it's quantum mechanics too, right? Momentum squared divided by 2m.
Yes.
2m. Yeah, which is the same thing as 1/2 mv², which you might have learned in high school physics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I noticed here there's an example. I don't know if I'm jumping ahead of myself here, but we talked about how one thing that is not an example is a hair dryer in an aluminum box. Did you want to talk a little bit about that?
Oh, I just chose that one because the heat is obviously just escaping and that you can't model the system without modeling the heat escaping and stuff.
Okay. And why an aluminum box?
It just harks to this one XKCD. It's one of his what ifs. Mm-hmm. It's what if number 35.
Okay, and that is, like, what is the what-if question?
Oh, this what if you put a hairdryer in an aluminum box? And the answer is basically the box gets very hot because the energy that you expend within the box radiates outward because the box is not a closed system at all.
Okay.
I mean, but it would be a closed system if we had a perfect thermos, right?
Yes.
I think we got the gist across what a closed system is.
Okay.
Now, can you talk about what a wave formulation of classical mechanics would mean?
So as I said earlier, that I think of classical mechanics as Newton's laws. And by that, I mean differential equations. And by that, I mean we have three spatial variables and time. So we have vectors and we have tensors.
And we talk a lot about those real quick on Navier-Stokes, which is one of our episodes on vector calculus.
And so you can also reformulate classical mechanics in terms of conservation of energy. You can replace Newton's laws with kinetic and potential energies. And there are several theories that people learn in third year school, Lagrangian mechanics and Hamiltonian mechanics. And those are a reformulation of physics in terms of momentum and energy and potential energies. In 1834, Hamilton and Jacobi explored a wave mechanics version that is essentially equal to all the other versions of mechanics. There are different flavors of it. And so they had, in 1834, a wave equation, which is equivalent to the Schrodinger equation. So, and if I can add to that, I was just thinking, in a room with light from a lamp, we think of optics as a ray physics. However, when you start looking at the shadows of sharp objects, say a shadow from a razor blade, you will notice a fuzziness, and that's because you are probing the microstructure of light, the wave nature of it. That was forced on physicists when they started shooting electron beams through crystals, and suddenly it became obvious that mechanics has a wave nature to it.
That is absolutely wild. I love that story. I've read that story many, many times, and even though it's well-established physics at this point, I still find it fascinating. So with Isaac Newton, you know, a shadow, like if you have a flashlight and you do shadow puppets, those, generally speaking, are pretty rigid. I mean, not entirely, but pretty.
The shape is very close to the, it's very close to what you would think the ideal would be if you just projected it, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Where like if you made the object out of like soot and you just kind of like put the soot into the paper, ground it into the paper, and had that exact shape.
Yes, and that very much just from the looks of it, intuitively supports the corpuscle model, the bullet, the photon, that model. But you said that if you shine a light on a sharp razor,
or make it simpler, just a double slit.
Yeah.
And you will get diffraction patterns that only waves can do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a diffraction pattern is like, let's say you have a pond, you throw two stones in, and let's say the two ripples create like this interplay of like troughs and peaks, and that's how you have to add light and this is pretty much how we know that light has a wavelength, correct?
Yes, exactly.
The double slit type stuff.
Exactly.
And these kinetic and potential energy stuff, all this stuff that treats energy as a very general thing, which is kind of like spooky sometimes. Like there's this famous problem with a roller coaster in physics, and the loop-de-loop problem, the way that it really works is you calculate the amount of potential energy basically how much centrifugal force happens in a loop-de-loop, and you just do some pretty simple stuff and it turns out to be 2/5 of the height. So you could do some cool stuff with energy, and that doesn't change when you go, as our next section we'll talk about, into quantum mechanics. So now we're going to talk about the Schrodinger equation and exactly what it means and why it's so important. You had a point that you're going to bring up.
So high school kids aren't aware that they take high school physics and they're seeing Schrodinger's equation. Anytime they write conservation of energy, you are then given magical rules in third year or second year physics in college to turn it into a differential equation over the complex numbers. That is how the Schrodinger equation comes about. It is foisted on students and never questioned. But again, its origin goes all the way back to 1834. And there's a reason why we turn a classical equation into a differential equation. So there are, anytime you see a conservation of energy equation, you are looking at a Schrodinger equation, be it for an orbiting mass, an orbiting electron, oscillating spring, whatever the system is.
Yeah, I like that. One of the biggest frustrations, I think, in education is as you said earlier, the quote-unquote magic formula where you just do it. Like you don't really understand why. So it's really important for appreciating why you're doing what you're doing to understand the reasons behind it and not just arbitrarily do it.
Yeah, that's one thing that I hope to get across in this episode especially is I know myself as a student of anytime I've been a student and I haven't understood the reason why the equations exist, I don't remember it at all. It's good. That's one of the things that we appreciated about your papers was that you seem to really go into everything in a really straightforward sort of building things on top of things sort of way. So yeah, so you were saying that the fact that we can use a wave equation at all for mechanics in general is something that had been established like almost 200 years ago in 1834.
Right, almost 200 years ago. They had no reason to use the wave formulation, so they took the limit of it in geometric optics. So where optics are nice and linear rays.
Yeah, it's funny. So yeah, just from like an experiential standpoint, just from what people have observed through, you know, experiments, there's no reason yet, but that doesn't mean it doesn't, you know, necessarily right. work.
And can you talk about exactly what you mean in optics in this context?
In the world we live in, the everyday world, we think of optics as optical phenomenon as rays. But when you really start to pass those rays through double slits, you begin to see the wave nature of it. And so the formulation of mechanics in a waveform, it can be taken to the limit where the wavelength becomes negligible and everything is a ray. And that's what they were doing in 1834, formulating mechanics as a wave equation and taking the limit to where everything becomes rectilinear.
If I may piggyback on the point that you just made, and also our previous point that a lot of people just don't consider, this aspect of it. There was a physicist, I believe, Louis de Broglie. He was the one who said that, okay, so if light, you know, has both a wave and a particle, do things that we recognize as particles also have a wave-like property?
Correct.
That is to say, not only protons and neutrons, but even like complex structures such as DNA. And he was absolutely correct. I believe they've done the double slit experiment with things such as DNA strands, and those also have wave properties.
Yeah, it's really crazy what happens when you get down to that sort of level. And real quick, though, when we talk about the Schrodinger equation, we're going to be talking about this this variable / function / whatever you want to call it, psi. And psi is, in the Schrodinger formulation, a complex number, correct?
Psi is a wave function that is complex valued. It has, you know, typically three positions, x, y, z, and t, with complex valued values.
And so let's say we have this psi, and it's defined over space, right? So
yes.
If we have like a certain, like, you can imagine psi like maybe next to your elbow, like this isn't a good example, but like just to show you what psi could sort of look like, it's like zero at your elbow, and it's like, or psi ranges from negative, from
the wave function itself is from negative infinity to positive infinity in all dimensions, time and or space, and its integral over that is one. So you are somewhere.
Okay, cool. And if you multiply psi by its complex conjugate, which if psi is a complex number, is just we've discussed this before. Complex numbers, if it's something like 2 + 3i, which means 2 + 3 times the square root of -1, and you can model that as like 3x, 3 on the x-axis and 2 on the y-axis, and then the length of that is that number times its complex conjugate, which in this case would be the square root of 14 or something, or 13. Psi times its complex conjugate at some event is a probability that the particle that we're considering can be measured at that event.
Psi multiplied by its complex conjugate gives you the probability.
Yeah, and remember in the double slit experiment, you fire light through these two slits, and you get this diffraction pattern on the other side, which is like you have these lines that are weak, and then it goes like weak and then no light, and then stronger than no light, stronger, and then the middle it's the strongest, and then it's like the psi times psi's complex conjugate, when you consider the plane onto which it's being projected, that the wave function would look like what is graphed out when you look at the light, right?
My favorite example of the wave function is the orbitals in around a hydrogen atom. You have the s orbitals that are spherical, the p orbitals which look like dumbbells. That's just my mental image of wave functions. Of course, that's just for that particular system.
I want to do a quick little tangent on that, if I may, real quick. That is something that I learned in chemistry. I remember I understood the beauty of orbitals and gravity, but when it comes to the shape of orbitals around the atom, why?
So I took my kids to the Kid Museum here in Albuquerque many times, where they have vibrating plates of different shapes, and you can pour sand on them, and then you can change the frequency of vibration, and you get these beautiful geometric patterns. Those are the wave functions.
Got it. Okay. Wow. And I have not experienced that often. So basically, we have this museum here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, called Explora. And I'm sure these museums exist in many places where you've got demonstrations of physical science. And as you said earlier, you have a plate, a vibrating plate with sand, and you can change the frequency of the vibration. But as you change the frequency, what are some of the shapes that you see the sand make?
I don't know. I can't.
They look. They kind of look like what you might find on like linoleum squares, right? Like kind of like almost like squiggly, weird patterns.
Like beehive patterns. That's where the interference. It maps out the nodes.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, and the reason why this works, I mean, not the whole reason, but when you vibrate this plate, each part vibrates a little bit, and the parts that aren't moving, they collect sand, while the ones that do move, the sand kind of moves away from. But so that's what we mean by psi being a wave function in the complex space.
Awesome. So then in an atom, it's the same thing. It's just that instead of sand, you have electromagnetic.
They're the orbitals, or the probability shapes of the electron clouds.
Wow.
So now if we consider E to be, well, before we talked about how the energy of a total closed system is equal to the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. And we could write that as E equals P squared over 2M plus V, where E is energy, P is momentum, M is mass, and V is potential energy. And the reason why kinetic energy is always going to be measured the same way, correct?
Yeah, kinetic energy is always measured the same way. V, the potential, if we're talking about an orbiting system, then it's proportional to 1 over r, which if its derivative gives you 1 over r squared, Newton's law. If it's a spring mass system, it's 1/2 kx squared is the potential. So it takes many forms.
So, yeah, and so when we're talking about the Schrodinger equation, which again is... Well, this just what the Schrodinger equation just talks about. It gives It takes a formula for energy in terms of kinetic energy and potential energy, right? And then you put psi into this you have a few substitutions, which we'll talk about in a second. But you get this equation that has psi in it, and if you solve for psi, you get something that can tell us about the probability space, right?
Correct. So in a simple system, psi, spring mass system energy conserved, 1/2 kx squared would be the potential energy term, and then you'd have p squared over 2m would be your kinetic energy term. That's 1/2 mv squared in a different form. And then you have E, and E being a constant. What you do is you convert E into a partial derivative with respect to time. So what we have is a substitution where we turn E into a derivative differential operator on time and P into a differential operator on space.
Yeah, and the substitutions are basically that E is equal to the change in psi, which is our wave function, over time, and that P, which is our potential, what we're using for our momentum, is equal to I times H bar times the gradient of psi over space. And remember, the gradient of something is, as we talked about in our vector episode, it points towards the, if we're on a mountain, the gradient points towards the direction we need to go to climb the quickest. Right. So saying that the momentum is equal to the gradient of psi over space times h bar. Is there any physical explanation?
So if you look at the equation, P is squared. So it's actually the gradient operator squared. So it does no longer mean the gradient.
That's right, because E equals P squared over 2M.
Right. And so what we have is an equation, a differential equation in time on one side and space on the other. That's a separable differential equation. And if you solve the space part for, say, 1 over R potential, you get the orbitals of hydrogen.
Yeah, which at the time was... I heard that at the time people didn't appreciate how difficult this would be to solve for, like, in general, and thought that physics would be, like... just relegated to solving equations for like the foreseeable future. That was a view that some people had.
That has been a view, and probably still is within a certain small school.
Yeah, and out of the interest of our listeners, why is that not a view that everyone has now? Like, what informs the view that exists or doesn't exist?
What pushes that is that there are people who believe we have approached the end of physics. And by that, I mean what just happened at the Large Hadron Collider. No new physics was found. So it could be that the next thing we do is we build an accelerator so large that we create black holes, which can't be explored. That is the end of physics.
Experimental physics, at least, right?
I mean, right. So there's no more theory to be had because there's nothing more to explore.
And if I'm correct, we use I in P equals IH bar times the gradient of psi. We just put the I in there so that when we square it, we get a negative, right? To make the signs work out? Or does that have a physical reason?
It has a physical reason in that the equation on the right-hand side for the spring has P squared and it has X squared. And so we're going to get a wave equation. The solution of this differential equations are sines and cosines, which can be formulated in terms of complex numbers. A sine theta is e to the I theta plus e to the minus I theta over 2.
Yeah, and basically what this is referring to is, and we'll be talking a little bit about this in the symmetry of the circle, is like if you take e to a complex number, you just take you take the direction that the complex number is going, where like that is, you take e to that real number, and that's how long the vector will be, and then rotate it around, you plug the rest into, I can't remember the geometric interpretation, but it's like you just keep rotating when you rotating when you multiply this complex number. So, and it's also kind of the reason why e to the I pi it's definitely the reason why e to the I pi minus 1 equals 0, which is a very famous equation by Euler. So now we're going to talk real quick about Maxwell's equations. One more. I think we've talked about him in the past. Do you remember? Did we talk about him in in the Black Hole series?
I don't think, not in the Black Hole series, no. If anyone listens to the podcast and wants to tell us what episode we talk about him on.
Yeah, we're only the hosts.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
But we have we're going to talk real quick about the formulation with the variables E and B, which is the electric field and the magnetic field. Then there's going to be another formulation, correct? Based on
potentials.
Yeah, potentials. The same as what we were talking about before, basically. And we'll get into that. But the first law that was discovered a while ago, we're not going to go too in depth, is Gauss's law, which says that the divergence of E, the electric field at a point, is equal to the density of electric charge at that point, divided by some constant that makes the units good, and it's a ratio constant called the electric permittivity constant.
I liked your phrase there. Some unit that makes the equations. What was it? Some unit that makes the equations good. Like that's what physicists do when you have a constant, right? It's sort of like spackle. Just like stuff it in there.
Yeah, I sometimes I try to challenge myself to think about what the units of G mean.
Yeah.
But so then we have, so basically the Gauss's law is just saying that, so we have Gauss's law, which is saying that if you have an enclosed volume of space, so like you just cup your hands together and you look at that volume, or like you'd put a balloon or a neon sign, anything that can, any shape, the amount of flow in and out of that space is in proportion to the amount of electric charge within that space. Then we have the same one for magnetism, which says that that the flow in and out of that space for the magnetic field is always zero. Then we have Faraday's law of induction, which talks about how the curl of E, which is basically kind of like the axis around which the vectors of E swirl, is in proportion and in the same place as the opposite shift in direction of the magnetic field over time. So if you have like current flowing through a wire and put a compass next to it, it'll kind of move in the direction of the it'll point towards the wire, right?
Correct. There's a right hand rule. If you wrap your hand around a wire, that your fingers are pointing, your fingers, which are curled, they have a circulation, are indicating the magnetic field lines.
And finally, we have the Ampere circuital law, which is kind of the opposite of the other one, the law that we just talked about. But we have some fudging constants, or I don't know that law too well. Do you know Ampere's circuital law in a way that with Maxwell's addition?
So Maxwell's equations were four equations that were constructed experimentally. And Faraday, back in the early 1800s, was good at using magnetic iron fillings to map out the fields. And over time, people discovered that if you open up a circuit, it creates a magnetic field. If you close a circuit, it creates a transient magnetic field. And so all four Maxwell's equations were derived that way experimentally.
And of course, all these formulations are talking about the magnetic field and the electrical field, which are really easy to, well, not easy. Well, they're easy-ish enough to measure in a lab, right?
You can make them manifest in elementary school with a magnet and some iron filings, and you put that together with a piece of paper that separates out the filings, and you can actually see, quote-unquote, see the field lines.
Yeah, because the little shavings, like, they form little tiny, like, little oblong blobs that point in the direction of the magnetic field. It's kind of like if you've ever seen a magnadoodle, the little lines. But what does it mean to write these in terms of magnetic vector potential and electrostatic potential?
So just as Newton's equations give us classical mechanics, F equals ma is really a differential equation for three components, i.e. a vector. The vector formulation of electricity and magnetism with three dimensions for magnetic fields, three dimensions for electric fields, can also be transformed into a formulation that uses potential energy versions, a vector potential and a scalar potential. And that is a very convenient form when we get into relativity. It is a natural four relativistic formulations of electricity and magnetism.
Yeah, it makes the two equations that we just talked about, Maxwell's equations and the Schrodinger equation as we formulated it, kind of easy to talk about together, correct? And that will be the next section?
Correct.
All right, now we're going to talk about the Dirac equations. To talk about that real quick, we're going to have to talk about the conservation of energy and momentum. And all that says is you have Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared. But how does that relate to the conservation of energy and momentum?
So in classical mechanics, we have conservation of energy. Say, if I keep you going back to mass spring, you have E, p squared over 2m, and k squared over 2. There's a four-vector version of conservation of energy. It's just a generalization in relativity. And so then we apply the same rules to turn that into a quantum mechanical equation. It's known as the Klein-Gordon equation.
Yeah, and so we have the conservation of energy and momentum. Equation itself is E squared minus P squared C squared is M squared C to the fourth.
Right.
And it's the same substitution, P equals IH bar times the Laplacian of psi gives like what you were saying, the Klein-Gordon equation.
Right.
Real quick, let's talk about a property called Laurent's invariance how it relates to transformations. And would you like to talk about that?
Well, okay, so in classical physics, we're familiar with Galilean transformations, and it just means that if you have Newton's equations are valid in one coordinate system and you move to another coordinate system, which is a Galilean transformation, you should still have the exact same laws. In special relativity, these generalize to so-called Lorentz transformations.
Yeah, and that's basically where you have the rotations as normal, but then you have a boost, and a boost is like... It's where you get that weird like Einsteinian like two people on a train kind of stuff. It's where somebody's going in Laurent's. Do they have to be going right towards you, or at least
essentially the two different frames are separated in space, and there's a constant velocity between them.
Yeah. So we have this Laurent's invariance, which in special relativity basically lets you turn any set of coordinates into any other ones, given that we know the relationship in real space-time between the two, right?
Correct. And the equations of relativity should remain valid no matter what coordinate system you change to.
Yeah, and so what does it mean to say that the Dirac equation... Well, real quick, before we talk about exactly that, this Dirac equation... the Dirac factor, the equation that we just talked about, which is where we took E squared minus P squared C squared equals M squared C to the fourth, it itself says that basically energy is like the hypotenuse between momentum and mass, is that you take the substitution, we give us the Klein-Gordon equation. So you take the Klein-Gordon equation and you factor it and you get beta K PK plus MC times gamma lambda P lambda equals...
So what you do is you take the Klein-Gordon equation, which is a differential equation, and Dirac, for reasons that are historical, factored it into two differential equations, each one of them being the Dirac equation. It happens that one describes the electron and the other one describes the positron. The way you factor it is it forces you to have coefficients which are complex valued.
Yeah, so in the same way that if we do x squared equals negative 2, you can't solve that using real numbers. You have to use complex numbers. These require quaternions, right?
Correct. And so each individual Dirac equation in the factor is only using complex. On totem, it's a quaternion, which is I equal to square root of negative 1, j, same thing, k, the same thing. It's a vector system.
Yeah, isn't the famous equation I squared equals j squared equals k squared equals ijk equals negative 1? Isn't it on a bridge somewhere?
It's on a bridge.
Yeah, so he was thinking about it one day, and he had a nail in his pocket, I think, and he scratched it onto the side of the bridge, and it's been, like, immortalized ever since.
He being Hamilton.
Oh, that was Hamilton? Okay. I can never remember people, but thank you. And so what does it mean that the Dirac equation is not Laurent's invariant?
So if you consider the Maxwell's equations and you transform them and you do Lorentz transformations, in the new coordinate systems, you recover back Maxwell's equations. Dirac's equations, when you transform them, a Lorentz transform, you do not get. You get some gobbledygook math. And so what people did is they started adding correction terms, just guessing. And it turned out that the correction terms are Maxwell's equations. In other words, Dirac equation plus Maxwell's equations combined are now fully Lorentz invariant. And that was a major discovery.
And is the Schrodinger equation Lorentz invariant?
No, it is by default a classical equation. It takes classical potential and kinetic energies.
Okay. Oh, and classical obviously can't be Lorentz invariant because they have different ideas of what simultaneity is. So let's talk about symmetry, which we have to have our own episode on sometime. We've been wanting to do it for a while, right?
That's right. Symmetry and breaking symmetry.
Yeah. So symmetry is obviously, somewhat obviously, when you can do an operation on something and get the same thing back, right?
Correct.
So like you have symmetry between you and your apparent image in a mirror because all you have to do is rotate through the fourth dimension and you get back the same thing you had before, or just flip it. What does it mean to say that a circle is symmetric?
Well,
rotationally.
The symmetry, I'll talk about it in terms of e to the I theta. It means that if you rotate a circle by an arbitrary angle, you still have the circle. It still looks the same. And so wave functions, you can multiply them by e to the I theta. You're rotating them in complex coordinates. It has no effect on the physics when you take the wave function, multiply it by its complex conjugate. So there's an inherent symmetry of the circle, an S1 symmetry. So in the Dirac equation, you have inherently the symmetry of the circle. In other words, you can multiply the wave function by e to the I theta, and you don't change the physics of it. It happens that it describes an electron, positron, photon. As physicists began to discover more particles, they took the S1 symmetry, the e to the I theta, and began to explore others. A richer symmetry would be the symmetry of all rotations, the group of rotations through theta, phi, and some other angle, psi, say. And that became a model to build further theories. In fact, it built the electroweak theory, which combines weak force with electricity and magnetism, and ultimately the standard model, which now has the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic force as a set of symmetries growing richer. And gut theories are even richer group theories.
This relates to the fact that you can't have physics in every dimension, right? As using physics as we understand it.
Correct. I mean, from a physicist's point of view, you would think, well, I'm going to explore lots of different group theories as possible extensions of what we haven't observed yet. And you do that because there's still a lot of problems with the standard model. So we know it's not correct. What the mathematicians did is they were doing exactly that, but they were generalizing it and using algebraic topology in a theory called fiber bundle theory. And they've already explored what fiber bundles, what structures are nice and differentiable. And I think I've tried to come up with an example of what one when a case when it is not friendly. And so here it goes. If you imagine a Möbius strip, which is a piece of paper that you can draw rungs on, it looks like a ladder, twist it and glue it, you have a Möbius strip.
And that is a half twist, correct?
Half twist.
So
yes.
So it's like if you took a ring, you just cut the ring and then you twisted it halfway and then glued it back together.
Correct. And so it's one sided. If you actually put your finger all on it, you stay on one side.
Yeah. So, where you travel twice the distance, obviously.
Correct. And if you imagine projecting light from above onto the table below, you'll see a circle down below.
And we're imagining kind of like a maybe an overhead projector where we have a Möbius strip on the projector slide, and we're looking at from above. We just see a circle, right? That was projected.
And the circle is nice. It itself is a manifold. You can take derivatives on it. It's a nice object. The Möbius strip, as you go around the circle once, the rungs on the ladder, as you come back around once, they have flipped. They're now pointing in the opposite direction.
And just, we're talking about a really, really thin Möbius strip, right? Where we don't care about the shape of, obviously, the width of
No, it's a strip, yeah. And you've drawn lines on it, you know.
But what I mean is, like, let's say this, in physical space, let's say we made this out of paper, the shadow that it would have would be kind of like a weird wobbly kind
well,
of
no,
thing.
Well, no, I'm just imagining the center line. Just yeah. Imagine the center line of the Mobius strip being projected down as a circle.
Cool, just to clarify everything. Anyway, sorry, continue.
So the rungs, in order for the rungs to come back to their original orientation, you have to go around twice. The rungs are discrete. They're either correctly oriented or oppositely oriented. That is not differentiable. That is a case of a fiber bundle structure where you shouldn't bother with physics. Physics is like differentiation. Well, the hairy ball theorem.
He said theorem.
Theorem that goes back and it essentially says you can't comb a hairy ball. There's always going to be a how would you call it?
A cowlick or a part?
Yeah, right. And what it means for the Earth, say, if we're talking about wind velocities, is there must be, from math, a proof, there must be a point where there is no velocity.
And to talk about exactly what combing a ball means, like you could comb a donut if you had a hairy donut, because you could either comb it like around the ring, or you could make them make all the combs going. Round towards the either the bigger radius of the big ring or the smaller radius of the the cross section, right?
Correct.
But so
at that point where there is no velocity, you can't define differentiation in a vector sense. That's an S2 manifold. That's the surface of a sphere.
So the hairy ball theorem demonstrates that you can't have physics in S2.
S2. Okay. So it turns out that the ones that are friendly are S1. S3 and S7, and that's it.
Yeah, those are the only spheres from 1 to infinity, right?
Right, that are rich enough to be good for physics. And so that's, a physicist would be ignorant of that, the mathematicians are not. And so that's essentially, you can codify physics in a very compact form, whether you're talking about general relativity or theories. These are so-called algebraic group theories. Essentially, it's about differentiation. In general relativity, it's about differentiation in space-time. In group-based theories, the standard model, it's about differentiating the group itself. As I said, the circle is a continuous group. You can do derivatives on that manifold. It's a group thing because you can rotate arbitrarily and still get the circle back. So there are group theories and geometric theories. They have the exact same fiber bundle differentiable structure.
All this like weird, I mean, just it's so weird that at the beginning of this episode, we started with real numbers in classical mechanics, and just we have all these, I mean, anybody who studied physics, just it's just bizarre how we have all these, how simple physics really is given the data, it seems like.
It is, and it is a shame that at the senior level, there is no finishing course that just covers this, given in a semester, and then perhaps a more advanced finishing course for master's and PhD students. The vast majority of physicists and mathematicians out there are ignorant of this, and I think it's a sad state.
We have some papers by Alex, and if you want them, you could just go to breakingmathpodcast.com/papers.html. That's our... Now, like, we've only had one paper so far on episode 1, but now we'll have some of Alex's papers there, too.
That's right. Episode 1 and episode 41.
And I will be giving you the 3 books in which chapters, the key ideas are most compactly and clearly presented.
This excites me because I know that this episode was thick. You guys saw how I was so quiet this episode. I didn't want to intimidate anybody, you know what I mean, by getting too technical. So I'm just kidding. But like everything in this episode is very, very well cited. For that, we thank you, Alex. Those
You're
citations
welcome.
Are going to be available also. What do you think on the page? Like,
yeah, just go. There'll be probably like a little link there on the. It'll be just go to breakingmathpodcast.com/papers.html and you'll find the papers there.
Cool. And all the other 39 papers are coming, right?
God.
You feel bad now?
I feel pressure. Physics is a study of the simplest natures of physical systems, and this simplicity sometimes becomes apparent in the relationship between math and physics, and how deep connections are found between concepts where those relationships are not very physically obvious. We have explored how the nature of the fields we use to approximate physics shape the nature of that system, vice versa, the possible future realms of physics, and how these concepts and others are intertwined. I'm Sophia.
And I'm Gabriel.
And this has been Breaking Math. With us, we had on Alex Alanis. And Alex, is there anything else you'd like to say about what we've discussed?
No, just thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. And if you guys have any feedback or questions about Alex's papers, please send them. We'd love to further this discussion.
Absolutely. I'd be glad to do that.
And a special thanks to Ian Harris, who did some voice work on the episode. He has a podcast, Critical and Thinking, with Ty Barnett. And he has a TV special on Amazon called Extraordinary. And a website, skepticmedian.com. So thank you.